And most Stanford freshmen are taken in by the site. About half of tenured history professors whose job it is to be able to go into archives and correctly identify information get it wrong. But there's one group that always gets it right and does it very quickly and efficiently. And that group is fact checkers at news organizations. And what fact checkers do is very different from what everyone else does. So the moment fact checkers arrive at a news site, the first thing they do is leave.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Hey, welcome to Digital to Learn. I'm here with my co-host, Tiffany Snyder.
Hi, everyone.
We're so glad to be here today with our guest, Justin Reich.
Justin Reich is an educational researcher interested in the future of learning in a networked world. He is the Mitsui Career Development Professor at MIT and Director of Teacher Systems Lab, which aspires to design, implement, and research the future of teacher learning. He is the author of Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education, from Harvard University. He is the host of the Teach Lab podcast and five open online courses on edX, including Sorting Truth from Fiction, Civic Online Reasoning, and Becoming a More Equitable Educator, Mindsets and Practices. Justin is a former fellow and faculty associate of the Kirkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.
We're going to talk about his book today, which coincidentally is number one on the Amazon list in education. That book, of course, you know, because you all have it, is Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Looking forward to this conversation. Welcome, Justin.
Thanks so much for having me, Brad and Tiffany.
Glad to have you here. Okay, Tiffany, let's dig deep into the Justin story.
All right. Very important question. If animals could talk, which one would be the rudest?
I have some loons that are living on a lake nearby me, and they're laughing and giving people a hard time all the time. So probably the loons.
Very
easy
good.
Easy answer.
Okay, if you could completely get rid of one month of the year, which month would it be and why?
Well, where I am in Vermont right now, it depends on the year, but it's either March or April is what we call mud season around here, when the lake melts and the buds aren't on the trees yet and the snow is still around, but it's kind of in mushy, icy piles. It's a cold, hard time of year. Although, interestingly, it was Henry David Thoreau's favorite time of year. He saw in it the potential for new life and the rebirth of spring. But it's pretty gross, actually.
Wow.
Are you looking at right now on some beautiful scenery?
Yes, very beautiful scenery. So a lake and the leaves starting to turn their colors and those kinds of
nice.
Things.
Nice.
This next question is subjective, but what is the silliest feature of your dream house?
Man, the silly. I mean, it probably has to have a pole to slide through multiple floors, right?
of course. Kind of
fireman's pole that somehow lets you like stop at any of the different floors in the house. And the dream house is probably some kind of like Minecraft inspired wizard's tower that's floors narrow and high.
Is it in Vermont?
I don't know. I mean, it's not in Vermont in March, but probably moves.
I can move. There you go.
Are you a native of Vermont?
No, we're actually just here for the year. I usually have to live near Cambridge, Massachusetts, because I work at MIT. But my family's had a cabin up here for a long time, and we moved here for the year because there's more school days and less COVID.
Nice. Wow. Very good.
Cool.
What a wonderful thing. So we know you have a lot of talents, but what's the one obscure thing that you're talented at doing?
So I do a lot of outdoor sports. I'm not particularly adept at any of them, but you know, I can canoe and kayak and ice climb and rock climb and hike and sail a little bit. And I can travel with reasonable proficiency in many different kinds of craft over in many different environmental conditions.
Wow. Amazing.
All right. We got one more of these for you. If you could invent something, what would it be?
Yeah, that's easy. We need to invent something that pulls carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
Absolutely.
Yes, we do.
Energy, and does it really well and at very large scales. And we need to invent it very quickly or we're in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. And rumor has it that you're actually working on such a device. Is that true?
No. My wife is a material scientist and she handles most of the kind of environmental issues. And then, the heart of what I do is kind of trying to, in my own small way, address issues of democracy that makes it possible for people to have civil discourse among an educated populace in order to be able to decide that we need to do things like build machines and fund them that pull all the carbon out of the air. I don't know that either of us feel like we're being particularly successful right now, but that's the game plan in our house.
Love that.
That's a new one for me. Material scientist. What is that?
Solid state chemistry. Understand the atomic property of materials so that you can build things that have the characteristics and specifications that you want, and so that you can invent new kinds of materials. I mean, a lot of what they do now is sort of look at the supply chains of the different kinds of things that we use in our lives, from paper to electronics and other kinds of things, and say, okay, well, the very worst, most environmentally damaging part of that supply chain is here, and let's start figuring out how we can cut that part of it out and replace it with something more sustainable.
That is wonderful. You have written about so many timely things, but one of the things you've written about is civic online reasoning. How are we doing at that? And what is it actually in your mind?
We're in rough shape on that for sure.
Okay.
Civic online reasoning is a term that was developed by Sam Weinberg and his colleagues at the Stanford History Education Group. And it refers to the set of skills that are required for people to be able to sort truth from fiction online. We have a new online course that's free for everybody on edX. We even have a coupon so you can get the verified certificate for free called Sorting Truth from Fiction, which will run from now as we're recording this interview through the end of October, and then it'll be available in different ways after that. So if any of this that I'm about to say is interesting to you, you can hop in and learn more.
Absolutely.
It's basically, how do you search the internet and identify whether or not things are true or false? And it turns out that for the most part, we've been teaching people how to do that exactly wrong. And just about everyone is really bad at it. So Sam Weinberg has done this research where he studied middle school students and Stanford freshmen and tenured history professors. And he gives them tasks, like he'll point them to the American College of Pediatrics website. Now, the American College of Pediatrics is a splinter group labeled as a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center for being strongly anti-LGBTQ. So it's basically sort of an anti-gay group of pediatricians. And it has a few hundred members, unlike the American Academy of Pediatrics, which has 40,000 or 60,000 members. And he says, does the American College of Pediatrics, not knowing that it's a splinter group, is this a reputable site? Oh. And most Stanford freshmen are taken in by the site. About half of tenured history professors whose job it is to be able to go into archives and correctly identify information get it wrong. But there's one group that Sam studied that always gets it right and does it very quickly and efficiently. And that group is fact checkers at news organizations. And what fact checkers do is very different from what everyone else does. So when people arrive to a page, they go and they spend a lot of time looking at that page. They look at the about page, they scroll vertically, they look up and down, they look at different things. Fact checkers do none of that. The moment fact checkers arrive at a news site, the first thing they do is leave. They use a technique that Sam calls lateral reading, which is they open a new tab and they start looking up American College of Pediatrics on Wikipedia. They look it up on other sites in Google. They search around and they sort of orient themselves to how other people view this site. And it turns out that that is a very effective strategy. The second strategy that they use is called click restraint, which is they're not drawn in by the first thing that they search for. They actually spend more time looking through, the first page, sometimes even the second page of Google results before they dive in. So the civic online reasoning starts with these two really important skills, lateral reading and click restraint. And the problem is, for the last 25 years, we have not taught kids how to do that on the internet. We've used these sort of checklist-based approaches. People may have heard of the CRAAP method, C-R-A-A-P, or other kinds of checklist approaches, which encourage people to stay on the site. And the problem is the bad guys have all of the checklists. The bad guys know everything they need to do on their websites to make them look credible and authoritative. In some ways, it really is a national crisis of our civic discourse that there's a set of skills that proficient people use to search the web that work, that basically teachers and professors and students and the vast majority of our people in our society don't know and are essential for navigating the internet. So my interest in this work is a lot of what I do is online learning for teachers. So I'm interested in what are the fastest ways that we can disseminate Sam's finding to the 3.5 million people who teach in K-12, to the, another 3.5 or so million people who teach and work in higher education. And then ultimately, we've got to get the message out to 57 million school children in the United States and the other, 250 million or so people in the U.S. It's an enormous, daunting challenge. And if we don't solve it, then, we have a population that's really susceptible to misinformation and disinformation.
And it seems like that's a skill set that could be integrated rather easily across virtually every academic discipline.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it would help quite a bit. I mean, it certainly would help right now during pandemic times. We're asking even more than usual for students to be able to find new information and navigate online. But it does have the problem, which is that, if it's everybody's responsibility, then kind of no one is accountable for it.
Absolutely.
It's not clear how to engage with, the sort of department groups in different places or the disciplinary societies. Indiana Wesleyan, you probably don't have anybody who's responsible for teaching these kind of foundational skills. Like some departments could decide for themselves that it's important that's that true. They do that. Mm-hmm. There's a library media group that would probably be willing to teach these things to anyone if they learn them, but they also don't have like direct points of communication. Maybe there's like a library orientation unit, in the sort of click through college orientation and things like that. And this is systemic of what I write about with a lot of different things is that, we can create an online course that can very effectively teach people these skills. We hope we've done that, but that is like part one of a much more complex problem, which is that our organizational systems are these complex ecosystems of people with different interests and different needs. And sort of, us tossing technology over the transom is not going to solve this problem. It's going to be us engaging with department heads, with the National Council of Social Studies, with the kinds, with library media groups, with lots of other organizations to build their capacity to learn these skills, to teach them to their colleagues, to teach them to each other, to figure out different models of how they fit into curriculum. That's really the hard part that's sort of the crazy thing behind this is that the two skills we're trying to teach people, you can explain them in two sentences. They work very effectively. It's not that hard to illustrate them with online technology, but the challenge of getting everyone to learn them, especially given, that we to some extent had a false start through these checklists and how we've been teaching search literacy for the last 20 years. It's a daunting, daunting problem.
Now, this course on edX, Sorting Truth, is the target audience for that teachers and facilitators? Is it students, both?
No, we're aiming just for teachers.
Okay.
I think, certainly if college students or high school students took the course, they could just ignore all the parts in which we say, and here's how to show this to your students, and just do the parts and say, here's how to do these things well. And our courses typically have a series of components. So there's a small number of expert lectures and presentations from Sam and me about these skills and about how to learn them. They're a series of, we call them Voices in Practice case studies, where we go into classrooms of people who are teaching these skills and help educators get a sense of what this looks like in practice. Most of those were filmed pre-pandemic times. And then we have a series of interviews that we did very recently with a bunch of educators who are using this curriculum, because we think it's really important. You know, teachers want to hear from people that are like them.
Yes.
And Sam and I are kind of pointy-headed academics, far removed from things now. Although I teach these skills to my students. And then, you know, another big project we have in my lab is that we think when teachers learn, they have insufficient opportunities to practice. So when teachers learn, they listen to people talk about teaching and they talk with each other about teaching, but they very rarely do teaching. So we've built a set of digital clinical simulations in a platform called Teacher Moments, which immerse you into challenging situations in teaching these skills. So, you know, you could, through your laptop or on your phone, you'll see a bunch of different scenarios, read a bunch of different scenarios of kids sort of making mistakes as they're searching or experiencing common misconceptions or other things like that. And then we sort of drop you in that, and a text box comes up or a microphone icon comes up, and you have to say what you would say to the student in that moment. In a couple places, you have to make some choices about the kinds of approach that, that you want to do and see the consequences of that. So it's a way of trying to make the course more practiceful for learners.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. Now, another area that you've published on that we're interested in is equitable educators. Can you share with us your work in that area and the mindsets and practices of what it means to be an equitable educator?
Sure. So this is work that we started maybe a year and a half ago. I'll give you a little bit of the background of it. We were doing work with computer science teacher educators. These are a neat group of people to work with, because America is kind of building the field of computer science teaching. And so computer science teacher educators are really at the forefront of building this field. And they've done a lot of really fabulous work on issues of equity. But one of the things that we observed is that they had a lot of great thoughts and research about policy kinds of things. Who should get access to these courses? How do we improve that? They had a lot of great research on curriculum. What kinds of resources would people need to be able to teach an equitable curriculum? You know, a huge issue is that most computer science classes are optional and they're overwhelmingly taken by white and Asian boys. And Black students, Latino students, Native American students, women are less likely to create these courses. And there's thought that, you know, there are policy reasons for that. There are curriculum reasons for that. There are certainly societal reasons for that. And there's lots of great work on lesson planning. You know, what are lessons that you can do to make sure that kids who have already some programming experience don't have a huge advantage in these kinds of classes? And, you know, there's a way to sort of disrupt the preparatory privilege that's involved there. But the thing that we observed that there was not as much of, which connects to this idea of practice, is that there wasn't a lot about what exactly do you do as a classroom teacher day to day, moment to moment, in the, you know, in the 50,000 decisions that you're going to make in a 42-minute period. How do you think through those decisions through a lens of equity? And that is what we got really interested in, what we ended up calling equitable teaching practices, not just the conditions that you create, but the sort of specific moves that you do. And we did a series of our podcasts, the Teach Lab podcast. The first season was all about these equitable teaching practices. And we found that really it was hard, even for experienced educators who had thought a lot about these things, to be able to articulate to people in a day-to-day kind of way, what do you do? So that's what we wanted to be able to articulate and share in this class. And we ended up drawing quite a bit from the work of a guy at Vanderbilt named Rich Milner, who's just a really wonderful researcher and teacher educator who has come up with these ideas of educator mindsets. The way that we ended up articulating it is that there are a series of ideas that are in tension in schools, and they are often way out of balance in schools. And if you can look anew through your teaching decisions, through rebalancing these mindsets, then you can make better decisions and have different kinds of practices. So one that maybe many educators are familiar with is the idea of asset framing versus deficit thinking. We can think about our students by asking ourselves, what are the strengths that they bring towards solving these challenges? Or we can think through a lens of deficits. What is the standards in this unit or curriculum, and how far have they fallen short of those standards? And we see an enormous amount of this right now. The whole frame of learning loss coming into this year is a deficit kind of view. It says there's a bunch of stuff that students were supposed to learn and they've fallen short of learning it and now they're in real trouble, when one could also bring a more asset framing, which says, you know, young people in this country just went through an incredibly difficult period of learning, but they learned all kinds of skills about engaging with technology, around self-directed learning, around being independent. There's lots of ways that they've learned and grow, and we need to celebrate that and build off of that. And our point is not that asset framing is always right and deficit framing is always wrong. Like, of course, we need to recognize that third graders last spring missed a bunch of things that they need to know in fourth grade. But we so commonly bring this deficit framing to our work. We particularly bring this deficit framing when we think about poor kids and less well academically served students, that we need to be more intentional about choosing more often to bring an asset frame to our work. And when we re-look at scenarios through the lens of assets, we will find, you know, many more ways to look at our students, especially our historically marginalized students, and treat them with dignity and in ways that help them learn more effectively. So this asset deficit is one of these balances. Aware and avoidant is another. There are lots of circumstances, you know, race affects almost everything that happens in schools in one form or another, and we're incredibly avoidant of that fact. When we see that some of our most effective educators at serving our least well-served students are aware and engaged on those issues. They're talking about the racial inequities in their school. They're talking about the effect of race on their society. A third of these dimensions is sort of being aware of what's happening in context, being context-centered, or being context-neutral. People saying, well, you know, what happens in school is what happens in school, and what happens at home or in the rest of their lives doesn't really matter, versus saying, oh, their communities are these incredible sources of strength, of resilience, of funds of knowledge, of those kinds of things to be able to bring in. So we go through four pairs of these mindsets and then try to say, all right, so having thought through these mindsets, what are some choices that you can make in your day-to-day teaching practice that kind of rebalance these out-of-balance mindsets? And just for completeness, the fourth is equity versus equality. In a lot of places in schools, we think that the right thing for teachers to do is to do the same thing for every student. And an equity focus says, let's try wherever we can to instead give each student individually what they need to be successful, rather than saying, well, you all got the same thing and it's sort of sink or swim from here.
Mm-hmm. Wow. This has been so much fun having a conversation with Justin. We'll be back for another episode. And if you're smart, you'll listen in on that as well.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.